next in the case of Dixon against ATI Latish LLC.
May it please the court. My name is Juan Monteverde with Farukim Faruqi, representing the plaintiff and appellant Irene Dixon. And this morning we're going to be asking the court to do two things. One, to follow the law and not permit that the individual defendants use improperly the business judgment rule to defend themselves on a duty of disclosure. And secondary, that the pleadings that were submitted to the court adequately pleaded a duty of disclosure under Rule Number 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It is one of the corporate tenets that directors owe duties to its shareholders. Within those duties is the duty of care, which encompasses the duty of candor and or disclosure. Here, Latish and Allegheny Technologies enter into a merger agreement for which shareholders needed to approve the transaction at a shareholder meeting. In order to proceed to that shareholder meeting, they needed to put forth a proxy statement or registration statement, which needed to be complete and provide all material information. Plaintiffs argued that that registration statement failed to provide adequate material information. The issue, however, was never litigated before the lower court because at a motion to dismiss, the court determined that the plaintiff had not been able to establish a claim for duty of disclosure, and the rationale, at least one of them, was because the individual defendants here, the board of directors for Latish, could rely on the business judgment rule to avoid a duty of disclosure. Now, that is,
didn't the Wisconsin Supreme Court, subsequent to this case, decide the same thing?
Well, my understanding is there's been a lower court from the state court in Wisconsin, the Tomotherapy. I think that's the ruling, and that's our concern. Indeed, not even 6 weeks after this ruling, we already have courts following it, and it's wrong. I mean, there is no intent in a duty of disclosure. Business judgment was created so managers, officers would be able to conduct business, day-to-day business operations without being scrutinized by the judiciary. But the case was clear that the duty of disclosure is something that the court should have ability to scrutinize. There is the great treatise of Stephen Radin, The Business Judgment Rule, that goes on and on how the business judgment rule does not protect directors against duty of disclosure claims. Because the issue is in a case of disclosures whether shareholders have been provided with the appropriate information to make an informed decision. And there's case law after case law of, I will say, a lot of it in Delaware, because Delaware has developed a jurisprudence of corporate law, but the state of Wisconsin follows Delaware law when it seeks guidance. That's the Knotts opinion. Certainly, respondents will argue that there's times where they distinguish from Delaware law, and that is correct. With the Revlon duty, the duty to maximize shareholder is not one that the state of Wisconsin follows, because the state of Wisconsin follows a constituency standard. That is, that they can look at not only what's best for shareholders, but what's best for the people of the state, what's best for the employees, what's best for the environment. And other states follow that rule as well. But that's different than the duty of disclosure. The duty of disclosure carries no intent. It doesn't matter what the judgment was of the director, because that's not the test. The test is this piece of information one that a shareholder would want to have, and would that be a total mix of information?
That makes it sound like it's just a federal claim under Section 14 and the proxy rules.
But
if that's what you think this is, then it's preempted by the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act. So presumably you have to have some distinct state law duty.
Indeed. And we did.
Now what's the distinct state law duty?
Well, there is. The distinct state law duty is the duty of candor under state law in the state of Wisconsin, which has been recognized by Wisconsin law, and that's under the case.
You articulate it in some way that doesn't make it sound exactly like what federal securities law requires.
The trouble with that, Your Honor, is that the 14A claim and the state of the duty of disclosure claim under state law are similar in the sense that they both require information be given. The standard, however, is different. And that's really where the distinction is. And here we brought the claim. Originally the complaint was brought on a diversity claim under state law. Once the registration statement was issued, we determined to file an amended pleading where we incorporated also a 14A claim. But we're not arguing here the 14A claim today. All we're focusing is in the state law claim. And the duty of candor that has been recognized by this court or by the state court in Wisconsin under Stauffacher recognizes that Wisconsin has a duty of candor. And also, as I said earlier, Wisconsin follows Delaware law and there's ample jurisprudence in Delaware where that duty of disclosure exists. And
Counsel, didn't the subsequent amended proxies moot your duty of candor claim?
Well, and that's even a stronger issue that we had a claim. In fact, we did have a claim, and we know that today because they did moot some of them. There were four disclosures. Two were mooted after we filed our papers and after we filed our pleadings. They did moot them, but two remain live or two remain unaddressed. And I guess I'll jump ahead a little bit on that issue because I know my colleagues at the other side are going to argue, if this is moot, what are we doing here today? Well, there's two issues with that. One is that we don't believe they're entirely moot because we believe there is exceptions under which one could seek damages. Certainly the court, if this were to be remanded to the lower court, could create a quasi-appraisal doctrine from an inequitable standpoint, and we could try to figure out with experts what the value of the lack of disclosure is worth. One can look at the earnings and the effects on the market. And that's why this information is important, because we like to have efficient markets. And the stock market cannot operate without efficient markets. And I think we've learned that in the last couple of years. So these are cases that are very important for that issue. And secondary, I mean, this is an issue that if we don't deal with it today, it certainly could be repeated and would have evade review. Because the way the transaction was structured, there was cash and stock. So you, in fact, have stockholders who were Lattice stockholders now holding Allegheny stock who may be facing another merger. And again, we will not have enough time because the problem with mergers is once it's announced, literally within 90 days, maybe 120, maybe 150 days, it doesn't last even a year. The merger will be announced, submitted for a vote, and completed thereafter. So it's important that these issues be dealt with. But what's more important is that the courts follow the law, and with all due respect to the lower court, the court erred because the business judgment rule is not an applicable defense now, for disclosure.
Counsel, this line of argument puzzles me. I thought your argument in your reply brief about the mootness issue was that the defendants had not adequately relied on Section 180.0828 in the district court. And that set up the question whether they had or not. Because if they hadn't relied on that, presumably you could still get damages. So perhaps you might want to discuss that.
It is clear from the papers from the lower court they did not rely on the exculpatory statute. However,
now does one have to rely on that independently of the business judgment rule? It looks like a codification of the business judgment rule.
And that was going to be my next point. They do go hand in hand, Your Honor. But more importantly,
but then that leaves the possibility that by invoking the business judgment rule, you have preserved any argument about Section 180.0828.
Yeah, but I think we're splitting hairs a bit because you're not allowed to use business judgment for this claim. I think you would have to specifically reserve that, otherwise you would have waived it.
They say otherwise.
Indeed.
Right. They say the business judgment rule covers this, and if there's any doubt about that, 180.0828 covers this.
And the point I would like
That's
to make...
their position.
And even if they're correct in that point, Your Honor, we can still seek damages if we can demonstrate fraud or bad faith or disloyalty. That only exculpates a duty of care. That would be the lowest standard of negligence. However, if we can demonstrate recklessness or fraud or bad faith, a higher standard, we may be able to then... establish damages for the lack of disclosure.
I'm now completely lost. I hadn't understood you to be making such a claim. The duty of loyalty is always outside the business judgment rule. So if that were your claim, then in the district court you would say they've invoked the business judgment rule. That's fine for this duty of disclosure. But we're relying on a breach of the duty of loyalty. But did you argue that in the district court?
We did not argue that, Your Honor, because we did not anticipate the judge to misuse, business judgment rule.
They expressly relied on the business judgment rule. That's the reason you lost in the district court.
And that's
if
what
you were
here.
Going to make a duty of loyalty claim, one would expect that to be an immediate response to reliance on the business judgment rule.
And that's correct. So I want to refocus the court's attention. I suppose maybe we digressed in that. The point we're here today is because the business judgment rule was misapplied. And whether they...
To which the response that is now being made by your adversary is, who cares? Section 180.0828 covers this even if you think the business judgment rule doesn't.
That's for damages, money damages. We could craft a...
You can't have any prospective relief because the merger is closed.
You could ask quasi-appraisal. I could go back to the court and say those folks who relied on lack of information.
Look, if you wanted an appraisal, you had to demand an appraisal in the time specified by the statute. You can't follow a whole federal course of litigation and then get an untimely appraisal as a fallback.
That's
not how appraisal works.
Well, that issue was an issue that actually happened in Delaware Chancery Court in Berger v. Popko, where they found... After the close, the disclosure...
Is there any Wisconsin case that it says even somebody who does not timely demand dissent and demand an appraisal can get an appraisal after he files and loses securities litigation?
No, there isn't, Your Honor. But what there is case law in Wisconsin saying when we lack precedent, we do look to Delaware for guidance. And the reason why Wisconsin, as other states do that, is because Delaware has developed a great body of jurisprudence. But again, the mootness issue, I would say, even if there's no damages, is an issue of law that needs to be corrected. This court, I suppose, could affirm the judgment, but reverse the reasoning for that judgment. At a minimum, we could correct the law.
Counsel, we review district court's judgments, not their opinions. That's the difference between a case or controversy and an advisory opinion. It's pretty fundamental.
Just an idea was thrown out there, but I understand what Your Honor is saying. By going back to the point, we could even argue that we do need to have this resolved because this can happen again, and it'll never be reviewed. And we're creating or not following the law, and the law should be followed. I mean, I think that's fundamental. And then I'll move briefly on the next point: the disclosure claims that we did plead in our pleadings. We believe they sufficed under Rule 8, all it needs to be is a short, plain statement. I think the court heightened the standard by saying that we were not particular or precise enough, and I think that was erroneous as well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ronsky.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. Mrs. Dixon filed a complaint in this action really in search of a claim. And the complaint and the argument here really tries to do exactly what the Supreme Court said couldn't be done in Iqbal. And it's really just to invoke Rule 8, to unlock the door to discovery for someone who has nothing but conclusions. The amended complaint...
Did any shareholders dissent and demand an appraisal?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, Wisconsin doesn't have the full panoply of dissenters' rights that Delaware does, and I don't believe that dissenters...
I didn't ask whether Wisconsin's system is the same as Delaware's. I just asked whether anybody demanded an appraisal.
No.
Okay.
The amended complaint on the disclosure claims, it's important to, I think, look at what it did and did not allege. It did not allege any misrepresentation, any active misrepresentation.
By the way, am I correct in thinking that Wisconsin is a model Business Corporations Act state?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So its appraisal clauses would be about the Model Business Corporations Act norm.
They're similar, yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
It didn't allege any misrepresentation or factual inaccuracy. It didn't allege any complete omission, that there was some big topic, some material topic or subject matter that wasn't addressed. Really, all it alleged was that, with respect to topics that had already been addressed in the proxy, that there wasn't enough there, that something more had to be disclosed, but the more was never specified. And under any of the standards, whether you look at the way Judge Stadmuller applied the business judgment rule here, under Twombly or in Iqbal, under the TSC Industries case, which is governs, I think, the analysis both to some extent for federal securities laws claims and for common law claims, there wasn't anything to show that this was actionable. Even if there was an omission of some sort and they come in and say something's missing, that allegation is no more consistent with liability than it is with no liability. To say that something's missing is not to say anything about whether it's material, whether it needed to be disclosed, or whether anybody ought to have any liability for that. And in particular, neither in the amended complaint or in the briefing below, which was, I think, Judge Stadmuller's primary point, there was nothing to show how this allegedly missing information would have been viewed by a reasonable investor as affecting the total mix, or how these alleged omissions somehow rendered something else that was in the proxy false or materially misleading. And also, what was clearly missing from the amended complaint was any facts that plausibly suggested the absence of bad faith, the absence of good faith, or the presence of bad faith. And so, given the state of the pleadings, the question to Judge Stadmuller really became, and I think it remains here, is it enough for a plaintiff to just come in and say, you know, I want more, something is missing? And the implications of a rule like that would be very undesirable, I submit. For one, you would have exactly what Twombly and Iqbal don't want. You would have an easy route past a motion to dismiss for an entirely conclusory claim that forces expensive discovery. And in this particular context, the strategic objective here of the plaintiff's bar in these cases is to threaten the closing of the transaction, an economically viable transaction, to threaten it with a preliminary injunction. And to be able to get over that hurdle and wield that threat and leverage settlements or try to leverage settlements with, frankly, nothing, with no substantive allegations to speak of. And in that situation, what you'd have is that a proxy would never be done until some court ruled that it was done. And you would involve the court in all of these cases more than they already are, not just at the motion to dismiss it.
The statement, you'd involve the court in all large merger cases, well, courts are already involved in all large merger cases.
That is true, Your Honor, but many of them, using these applicable standards, are disposed of at the motion-to-dismiss stage. And under the plaintiff's rule, we'd be looking at full-blown preliminary injunction hearings or summary judgment motions in most cases. And what, of course, will happen if that transpires is that your rational corporate lawyers will then start to load up these 150-page proxy statements even more, with more and more minutiae and detail.
Yeah, they've already done that. Thank you very much. That's one reason why they're completely indigestible.
Well, I would not disagree with you there, Your Honor, and I don't think that's a condition that should be exacerbated because, of course, the whole point is that these are supposed to be helpful.
I'm now shocked. A corporate lawyer whose job it is to spend hours larding the statement with these extra pieces of information says that clients should be told to buy less of his time.
Well, I'm the litigator who tries to tell you that the corporate lawyers did a good job, Judge.
Right, you're the litigator rather than the transactions lawyer.
And I think also what would happen is you'd end up with the plaintiff's bar effectively trying to set the bar on what needs to be in here instead of the Securities and Exchange Commission, that at least in public company cases is charged with that duty. So for these reasons, Judge Stadmiller said, no, it's not enough to just come in and say, I want more. And if you can't show that something in the proxy is misleading and you can't show an actual misrepresentation, then you, what do you have to show? Well, you have to show some facts plausibly suggesting the existence of bad faith. And that, he used shorthand, that's the business judgment rule. And under state law, that's how we're going to apply it. And that decision was legally correct, and it was, frankly, eminently sensible. Now, as we've touched on in our brief, or not touched on, elaborated on in our brief, the court doesn't really need to get there because, in our view, this case is moot. And it's moot for two reasons. Number one, Dixon never further amended her complaint to address any of the later iterations of the proxy or the final version of the proxy. And there was never a complaint on file that actually addressed that document. And then, of course, she never moved for a preliminary injunction, although she requested in the amended complaint. She never filed that motion. There was a preliminary injunction hearing in the parallel state court proceeding for the same merger, and that was denied. And so the shareholders' meeting took place on May 6th, and the merger closed on May 9th. And we submit that moots the remedies that they seek here. I don't know that there's any real dispute. Obviously, the ability to have corrective disclosures is to have some kind of injunction. Obviously, that's mooted by the closing. The rescission remedy, we're not aware of any public company merger that's ever been rescinded. And if that claim is not legally mooted, it is certainly equitably mooted or impractical and not relief that could feasibly be granted.
You know, this circuit has expressly rejected the doctrine of equitable mootness.
Well, I know that the circuit has said, we don't like to use that phrase, but it has said that...
You've rejected the doctrine. There ain't no such doctrine in this circuit.
Take
a look at In Re UNR Industries.
All right, Your Honor, I will do that.
There is such a doctrine in other circuits, but we've said they're wrong.
Well, in any event, Mrs. Dixon didn't even move for a preliminary injunction, and she certainly didn't seek to stay or take any other protective action to protect herself after the motion to dismiss that would have prevented the closing from happening. So that leaves us with this claim for quote-unquote rescissory damages, and I'm not sure exactly what those are, but I know that three things are clear from the state of the pleadings. And that's, number one, that request for damages is really inconsistent with her allegations on the disclosure claim that she would suffer irreparable injury because there was no monetary or adequate remedy at law. Two, if you look at the amended complaint, there are no allegations of direct damages from any non-disclosure violations, either individually or on behalf of the class. And that would be very difficult to do here since the prevailing bid was by far the highest bid that was ever achieved for the company by a factor of about 20%. And third, Dixon did not allege, as Judge Stadmiller concluded, facts showing the absence of good faith. And in our view, that's where the Wisconsin version of the exculpation statute 180.0828 comes into play. And obviously, the briefs are what they are. We did not cite that statute in that form below. But the whole tenor and substance of our argument below was that you had to show bad faith or willful misconduct or some kind of breach of loyalty in order to move forward on these claims here. And Judge Stadmiller found that absent from the amended complaint. And in our mind, that moots or defeats any claim that requires that type of state of mind or mens rea. So we don't think that there's any legs to the argument that statute wasn't cited below. And now the idea that there's some basis now, 6 months later, when Mrs. Dixon never sought leave to amend below to come in and has a good faith Rule 11 basis for alleging intentional misconduct, we just think there's nothing to that. So we do believe that it's moot. And on the disclosures, we can talk about Judge Stadmiller's opinion or application of the business judgment rule if you like. In general, I think it makes sense in this context, and if it's cabined to cases where the plaintiff doesn't allege anything in the proxy is misleading as a result of the alleged omissions, as was the case here. And really, the two arguments that Mrs. Dixon has about that is, number one, that's not how we do it in Delaware. Well, that may be so, but this is Wisconsin, and Wisconsin has a broader interpretation of the business judgment rule, and I think there's no reason to think that Wisconsin wouldn't adopt the interpretation that Judge Stadmiller applied here, and I think there's certainly no reason to believe that Wisconsin would encourage the proliferation of frankly, strike suits like this one. And then the second argument is that this rule, the business judgment rule, would give the directors a license to lie, I think is the quote that they use in their brief. And that doesn't make any sense to me because an intentional or knowing misrepresentation would obviously constitute bad faith that would defeat the application of the rule entirely. So I don't think there's any...
violate federal securities law.
That too, of course. So I don't think there's any meritorious parade of horribles here.
Counsel, why are you not contending that the current claim is preempted by the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act? It's not a derivative suit. It's a suit about disclosure, and the federal rules cover disclosure, and the statute seems to me to preempt any disclosure-related litigation that is not filed as a derivative suit, which this isn't.
I will be completely honest in saying, Your Honor, that simply that argument had not occurred to me as we were briefing this issue below, and I have not considered that. I have no reason to think it doesn't apply. I just have not thought about it prior to this morning. Basically, I mean, I think this comes down to whether it's mootness or whether it's Twombly and Iqbal. There's nothing here but conclusory allegations, and so unless I can answer some questions, I'll conclude for the morning. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Monteverde?
Yes, sir.
I want to focus the court two things. One, for the record, we did not move for a preliminary injunction because we never got hurt in our motion for expedited discovery. And if one thing I've learned is that if you're going to move for a preliminary injunction, having evidence helps. And when our motion to expedite was filed, but not heard because it later on was determined that it was mooted after the motion to dismiss was granted, it was no longer an opportunity to move for a preliminary injunction. So it's not that we didn't try. We did try to create a record, and we were not successful in doing so. But I think what's important is to see what disclosures we were asking for here. And I go back to what I said earlier. The reason why these disclosures are important is because disclosures are money. This is how our markets operate. Now, everyone understands a stock is trading at X dollars, and they say, well, that's what the company's worth. Well, the company's worth that because there's information out in the market being used by hedge funds, being used by analysts, being used by shareholders that gets to that number. And that's efficiency in the markets. And that's why it's important to make sure proxies disclose material information. And what information we were looking for, it was of three different respects. One was, why are you selling the company as opposed to continuing your business prospect? You had put a strategic long-term plan in place, but you're deciding to no longer use that. Another was, why are you going to not talk to another bidder who seems interested and focus only with Allegheny Technologies? And the last was, you hired an investment banker. Why did you hire them? Is there any conflict? Do they actually own shares in Allegheny? It appears they had shares on the buyer. Is that a conflict? I mean, we just had a decision in Del Monte showing conflicts with Barclays was a concern. And the latter also dealing with Baird's analysis. Are these analysis a fair summary under the law? So these were not disclosures that one was just trying to scratch their head and try to come up with something. These are actually fundamental information that shareholders are entitled to have by law.
Counsel, if a company's initial proxy isn't thorough enough, shouldn't they be given the opportunity to file an amended proxy before being stung with a class action lawsuit?
Well, it's an issue of timing, and it's an issue of, I believe if, and I'm out of time, but if I believe if we don't file suits, the safeguards would go away and no one would be watching over their shoulders, and I think we contribute in that regard, and the judgment should be reversed, at least on the business
judgment. Curious, real quickly, who is Irene Dixon, and how many shares of Lattice does she own, and how was she personally upset by this?
Well, Irene Dixon, it's a client of the firm who holds many shares in many companies, and sometimes she contacts us to say, I don't like this deal, I don't know how many shares she has here, Your Honor, as I stand before you, but it's not a large shareholder. It's probably a nominal shareholder, which a lot of the activist litigation or activist shareholders involved in this litigation tend to be nominal. They care. They actually care. They invest in the market, and they want to make sure that the market is doing the right thing and information is out there for the public.
Did 99.9% of the shareholders vote to approve the merger?
Shareholders normally follow recommendations.
Okay.
And that's why it's important that the proxy be complete, because the analysts are looking at it, and they will not get recommendations if the analysts are not happy with it. So it's a circle.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.